and knowing he was innocent for what he did, they won't let him out of prison. We've had comrades who died in prison on their deathbed, and they won't release it for compassionate release, so they'll be dying at home, right, because of their politics. One particularly, Mutulu Shakur, right, the stepfather of the great rapper Tupac Shakur, right, he's terminally ill today, right, he asked for compassionate release several times, and they denied him, or probably martial law, he's going to die in prison. Okay, this is how they treat us, political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Oh, really appreciate you being with us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Jalil Motaki. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the political prisoners that were mentioned by our guests.
Assata Shakur. She is the step-aunt and godmother of late rapper Tupac Shakur and the sister of political prisoner Dr. Mutulu Shakur. She is 75 years old. Under U.S. President Obama's term, not only was she not pardoned, but the bail on her head increased from $1 million to $2 million. Dr. Mutulu Shakur. He is a doctor who specializes in acupuncture. He was very effective in helping people get off of drugs using his method. He was a black liberation activist. He's also the stepfather of rapper Tupac Shakur. He was charged and convicted for helping his sister Assata escape prison. He was eligible for parole in 2016, and despite being a model prisoner, his release has been denied. Currently, he's suffering from stage 3 bone marrow cancer, and he is 71 years old. There have been many requests made for him to be released on humanitarian reasons, but they all have been denied. Rochelle Sink McGee. Rochelle is the oldest political prisoner in the United States. He's 83 years old. He has only lived 16 years outside of prisons. The rest of his life he has spent behind bars. From the beginning, he was convicted of trumped-up charges based on racism. He says slavery 400 years ago and slavery today is the same, just with a new name. Momia Abu Jamal. Momia Abu Jamal is an internationally recognized journalist and black liberation activist. He was one of the founding members of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Panthers, and he has been known as the voice of the voiceless for his many years spent writing about issues relating to working class people of color, prisoners, and the underrepresented. He has written 8 books and countless articles and commentaries from a prison cell on death row in Pennsylvania. He has been incarcerated since 1981. He's 68 years old and suffering from various diseases. Imam Jamil al-Amin. Formerly known as H-Rap Brown, he served as Minister of Justice with the Black Panthers. He is a well-known Muslim leader now and has been in prison since 2000. He remains in jail despite another man admitting to killing the person al-Amin was accused of killing.
Over the years, there have been many political prisoners to die in prison or to be released and to die within days of their release in the United States. There are petitions of movements around the world asking for compassionate releases for these aging revolutionaries. Well, we will continue to follow it up right here and let you know about their latest situation. But for now, I'd like to leave you with this quote from journalist and political prisoner Momia Abu Jamal. Conventional wisdom would have one believe that it is insane to resist this, the mightiest of empires. But what history really shows is that today's empire is tomorrow's ashes, that nothing lasts forever, and that to not resist is to acquiesce in your own oppression. Well, the greatest form of sanity that anyone can exercise is to resist that force that is trying to repress, oppress, and fight down the human spirit. Until next time, we hope that we hear from you. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Monkeypox virus has taken hold amid ragged US system, ravaged by years of underfunding, messy bureaucracy, and coronavirus pandemic. We have prepared for you an article written by Jessica Glenzer. The piece is titled Slow Response to Monkeypox Exposes Tired, Overworked US Health Agencies. Advocates have said a slow and bureaucratic response that has seen monkeypox spread rapidly across the United States, with more than 1,000 cases in New York City alone, reveals just how badly battered local health agencies have been since the COVID pandemic. Once a rare African virus, monkeypox has taken hold amid the ragged patchwork of city, county, state, and federal agencies that make up the U.S. public health infrastructure. David Harvey, executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors, said, "Unfortunately, delayed actions mean monkeypox has spread within the U.S. community very rapidly." He said, "This outbreak has grown to be a public health crisis in America. We're still in a very chaotic situation at the state and local level with an organized response." As an explanation for the chaos, many observers point to how COVID reshaped the landscape for public health officials. Once considered neutral arbiters of information, many health officials were politically attacked following unpopular mask and vaccination policies. Across the country, public health officials were harassed, threatened, fired, or simply felt burnt out and quit. The situation was not helped as resources that had once been devoted to things like tracking communicable diseases such as tuberculosis or running routine vaccination clinics were suddenly diverted to COVID-19. Health clinics have struggled too, as testing and staff resources were devoted to COVID-19, hurting organizations that have already suffered years of underfunding. The result has been worse health outcomes for many basic public health services. Routine vaccinations for children have fallen, overdose deaths have exploded, and the U.S. has posted a record high rate of sexually transmitted infections for the sixth running year. As monkeypox has spread, the Biden administration has attempted to respond by releasing about 1.1 million vaccines and ramping up testing capacity, which has grown from about 6,000 to 80,000 per week. The World Health Organization, WHO, declared monkeypox a global health emergency recently, and the United States could follow suit by declaring monkeypox a national public health emergency, which would release more resources to local agencies. Lori Tremel Freeman, chief executive of the National Association of County and City Health Officials, said, "The system is tired, it's overworked, it's underpaid, it's understaffed," adding, "All the same issues that plagued us during the pandemic are still with us and haven't gone away." She said, "What's added to it with monkeypox and beyond is that we have also a workforce that has documented mental health trauma after the pandemic." Public health advocates want the President and Congress to allocate more funds to respond to the outbreak and for sexual health clinics in general. Public facilities have proven to be first line of defense with monkeypox, even as federal prevention funding for such work has fallen 41% since 2003. David Harvey said, "Local health providers are being asked to respond to monkeypox on top of an already out-of-control STI epidemic in America." Harvey added, "We're at the breaking point. We need the Biden administration and Congress to immediately fund STI public health programs and clinical services." Although anyone can catch monkeypox, the virus has primarily affected the men. Health clinics have often been frontline responders to the outbreak. Any close contact with an infected person can spread the disease. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, although the virus, which belongs to the same family as smallpox, is rarely fatal, symptoms can be excruciating, with painful lesions and flu-like symptoms. Freeman said up to 10% of people are reportedly requiring hospitalization, and many are showing up in emergency departments because of severe pain. The situation is exacerbated because testing for monkeypox is limited. There is no home test and results can take days. However, there is a vaccine for which people at heightened risk may be eligible. They may also qualify for treatment with the drug tecovirimat, sold at TPOXX. But the barriers are significant. Obtaining it can be tricky, and tecovirimat, usually reserved for people with severe symptoms, must be requested by doctors from the government's National Strategic National Stockpile, which involves significant paperwork. Moreover, Freeman said people without insurance probably lack access to both vaccine and drug. According to an analysis by federal officials, about 12.7% of homeless community lacks health insurance compared with 11.4% of the general population. Even if you do have insurance, there are hurdles backed into the U.S. healthcare system, such as trying to navigate between urgent care clinics, primary care providers, and state health departments. Freeman recounted a story about a local health department that asked its state for information about a monkeypox outbreak. The state replied to check with the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC then redirected local officials back to the state. She said, "There's a lot of finger-pointing going on here. We should have learned. We should know more now than we knew 3 years ago from our COVID response about what we need to do right now."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United States says it has killed the Al-Qaeda leader in Kabul, Afghanistan. Ayman al-Zawahiri has apparently been killed by a CIA drone strike over the weekend.
After carefully considering the clear and convincing evidence of his location, I authorized a precision strike that would remove him from the battlefield once and for all.
Biden claimed that no civilians were killed in the strike, but the U.S. is known for undercounting civilian casualties. Back in August 2021, the U.S. killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. Initially, the U.S. military claimed the strike killed ISIS-K members.
It was announced by the United States military that a drone strike in Kabul had killed ISIL operative who was getting ready, that they had caught him on the verge of another suicide attack at the airport. And then the United States was congratulating itself for saving lives. The story fell apart very quickly in the next few days. And even though the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, called it a righteous strike, it turned out that this was a man named Samari Amari, who was a employee of a California-based NGO, humanitarian organization called Nutrition and Education.
Afghanistan's ruling Taliban group have confirmed the strike and described it as a violation of the country's sovereignty, but they have not commented on Al-Zawahiri's death. Al-Zawahiri was 71 years old when he was killed in the drone strike. His death is seen as the biggest blow to Al-Qaeda since his former leader Osama bin Laden was killed by US troops in Pakistan in 2011. He had apparently taken over the leadership of the group after bin Laden's death. Al-Zawahiri grew up in Egypt and was a surgeon. He later joined bin Laden and is said to have masterminded the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Since 9/11 in 2001, he had been on the run and had a $25 million bounty on his head. Al-Qaeda has yet to issue a statement on his killing. Back in 2020, the United States signed an agreement with the Taliban in the Qatari capital, Doha. The agreement paved the way for the disastrous departure of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Based on the agreement, the Taliban had promised not to allow the presence of terrorist elements on Afghanistan's territory. Now, the United States accused the group of violating that deal. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The aim of the mission was to root out Al-Qaeda militants. The mission, which has lasted nearly 20 years, cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of Afghan civilians. The U.S.-Taliban deal showed that Washington failed to reach its objectives. But Afghanistan was the victim of hawkish U.S. politicians even before the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, well, the United States has been supporting terrorism. Al-Qaeda itself is an offshoot of outgrowth, as the Taliban, of U.S. support for insurgents who were resisting the Soviet invasion in 1979. This is our creation. Even Osama bin Laden himself was on the CIA payroll and was being praised by American presidents as a freedom fighter. So we have this history.
It's now a well-established fact that the United States helped create the Al-Qaeda in the 1980s against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. The operation to create Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan was masterminded by the United States and financed by the Saudis. And the logistical work was carried out by Pakistan.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan. And we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what? Sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military. And let's go recruit these Mujahideen. And that's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union.
Leaked emails also show that Hillary Clinton, the then U.S. presidential candidate, was furious over the money channeled by Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf Arab countries to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and the ISIL.
The war in Yemen has killed thousands of people and left a large portion of the population on the verge of starvation. But 2 months ago, a spark of hope was reignited among the Yemenis. The Saudi-backed coalition and the Ansarullah resistance movement announced an extension to the two-month truce, which was agreed upon in April. But now, the same hope has transformed into fear and anxiety for the civilians as the war-ravaged country awaits two scenarios: a new cycle of war or an extended cessation of conflict. The United Nations-sponsored truce has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war. But even though the truce lasted despite multiple violations from the Saudi side, there have been no reports of an extension. As the expiration approached, the UN ramped up its efforts to renew the agreement, which it says has resulted in improved humanitarian conditions and has led to a significant decrease in civilian casualties. The truce brought immense relief to civilians, but its true potential regarding effectiveness and longevity remain under question. One issue that persists is Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement being dissatisfied with its implementation, saying the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its obligations. Experts have also criticized the truce for failing to address the main and underlying issues behind the war.
Well, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudis, who did block shipments and engaged in a couple of skirmishes, but it was still much better than the previous state of affairs. And that currently it seems to be expiring without serious action to make it permanent, presumably mainly because, the Saudis are not willing to let go of this stranglehold they've got right now on Yemen, and they're not willing to let go of their hopes for establishing a puppet regime and getting control of this geostrategically crucial area. And the West has apparently decided to let them.
Yeah. Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen with the objective of installing a Riyadh-friendly regime and crushing the Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement. But while the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its goals, the war has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing war on Yemeni people has also sparked global outrage over grim violations of human rights. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has voiced concern over the torture and ill-treatment of Yemenis by the United Arab Emirates, armed forces, state security agencies, and on-state armed groups. Earlier this year, the UN expressed concern regarding the civilian casualties in Yemen. Many rights organizations have also condemned the acts of aggression against the Yemenis, especially children and women, and denounced the continued international silence on the crimes. But the June ceasefire, especially its extension in April, raised the prospect of peace in a country that has only faced destruction and gloom over the past years.
Well, it would be nice if a habit of peace had been established so that the hot war doesn't break out again right away. But again, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudi side. And the fact that they haven't been able to extend it is a bad sign. It suggests that the Saudis are unwilling to essentially admit that they made a mistake when they entered this war, and that they can't gain control over Yemen. And that admission would require a big change in policy, and right now they're not under enough pressure to do it. The oil prices have gone up. The Saudis are doing okay financially. They apparently are under no pressure whatsoever from the Biden administration to roll back or extend the truce or negotiate a lasting peace. So I don't see any indication, unfortunately, that the truce will continue.
Yemeni officials have, however, expressed their doubt over a third extension of the ceasefire. They say the UN has failed to bring the much-needed breathing room for civilians. Another matter which seems to be behind the Yemenis' doubt is the Saudi-led coalition refusing to fully commit to the terms of the truce, including halting its attacks. Natural gas is one of several commodities massively impacted by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The European Union receives about 40% of its natural gas from Russian pipelines, about a quarter of which flow through Ukraine. And now, in light of sanctions raised against Moscow and the months-long war, energy truly seems to be at the front and center of the conflict. Natural gas prices reached record highs in October 2021, and prices have kept climbing since hitting a new all-time high in March. Prices on the Dutch TTF hub, a European benchmark for natural gas trading, more than tripled between February 16 and March 7 before pulling back. Russia has been accused of using its natural gas as an economic and political bargaining chip. But despite all this, natural gas has continued to flow to Europe, except for a few extreme cases. An example of this would be Germany accusing Moscow of engaging in power play over energy exports. This as Germany, which imports 40% of its gas from Russia, sanctioned Moscow and is now facing record inflation in light of surging prices. Now Latvia has joined Poland, Bulgaria, Finland, Netherlands, and Denmark in being cut off from Russian gas. Gazprom says it has halted gas supplies to Riga in light of their violation of supply conditions. While Russia did not specify the violations, it had already cut off gas supplies to the other countries for refusing to pay in ruble. Riga had already decided to ban Russian gas imports from January 2023, and last week it even said it was not buying Russian gas from Gazprom. And on Saturday, Latvia said that Gazprom's decision would have little effect on the country. But while many European countries have expressed similar remarks in light of Russia's bans and rises in energy prices, their decisions seem to be going against their national interests, mainly as they have made such remarks while failing to find alternatives to cheap Russian gas. So what seems to be the case is a political decision at the expense of the people who have thus far incurred the unbearable rising costs of living.
Well, no. There is a very high-stakes game of geopolitical poker going on here, and Europe does need Russian gas. At the same time, these countries, many of them, I mean, Latvia, Poland, Bulgaria, are in the forefront, Poland, in the forefront of countries that want to defeat Russia, basically. I mean, they believe they have the moral high ground, that they have a good cause, but they really want to stick it to Russia. That is their goal.
Russia is the largest exporter of natural gas globally and the second largest producer behind the US. For decades, Russian natural gas has powered European homes and industries. In 1968, Austria and the Soviet Union signed a gas deal, and in the early 70s, natural gas shipments began arriving in West Germany. But in 1981, CIA intelligence assessment of a proposed 3,000-mile-long natural gas pipeline from Siberia to Western Germany warned of a trouble ahead. It said the pipeline would be a reliable source of gas for the continent, but would also give the Soviets political leverage over Europe. Now those problems are ringing true, but only since EU and the US have sanctioned Russia, leaving Russia with no choice but to exert energy pressure on Europe. As Russia tightens its chokehold on supplies of natural gas, Europe is looking everywhere for alternatives. Coal is back on the table and deals are being struck with new partners. Despite all this, fears are growing across the continent that a Russian gas cutoff will force governments to ration fuel, risking both jobs and people's lives. Now the race to find alternatives to Russian gas has accelerated, but the question remains as to what happens if the economies tank badly, as they seem to be, and no alternatives are found. Will the EU unity against Russia fall apart?
I do not know the answer to that. Certainly, this puts great stress on European unity. In the long term, there are alternatives to Russian energy. Although Russia, you know, it's attached to Europe, it's part of the greater Eurasia region, and it is a source of not just gas and oil, but many, many other raw materials, which are now being cut off. And Europe and Russia are having a really painful divorce. And it's Europeans' governments mean for Russia to suffer the pain, but in fact, in a form of blowback, they are suffering it too.
Indications that such unity is bound to fall apart are already emerging. Some EU leaders are already calling for a reconsideration in the bloc strategies. Some have even labeled Europe's attempts of replacing Russian gas as being on a knife on edge. But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way, and experts say their problems may only worsen in the future.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of a recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to a steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession. The poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the UK, France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job, because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. The fifth point is that no part of the powers or legal duties of the judiciary as defined in the Constitution and related laws should be suspended. No part of them should be suspended. For instance, the Attorney General has certain duties in the field of public law. He should have full knowledge of public law. I will discuss one case of this later, so that he can be sure that public rights are not violated. This should be taken very seriously, and the law must be resorted to wherever it is felt that public rights are being violated. But I do not agree with the use of emotions and slogans in these cases. Rather, these matters should be taken care of in accordance with the law. This is an important task. There is also the issue of crime prevention. This is one of the duties of the judiciary and has been included in the Constitution. This matter must be taken seriously and not neglected at all.
دنیا
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the case of ordinary, everyday laws, the so-called conventional laws of the judiciary, I mean these laws that are about lands and which determine who each meter of land is owned by in cities and villages, these cases must come to a conclusion. They must be followed up on and finished up. If this is done, these land grabbers, these people who are taking parts of the mountains and the like, will cease to exist. Land grabbing itself is another source of problems. The sixth point is that the type of relationship between the judiciary and the executive officers in the judiciary is very important. This must be considered from different angles. One aspect is that the conduct of the officers must be monitored and supervised. Well, he just gave an order. I heard on the television about some of the things the officers are doing. These things should not be done to the suspects. This is one of the things that needs to be taken care of. The behavior of the officers should not be exaggerated, excessive and the like. Another aspect is that the judiciary should not be influenced by the opinion of the executive officers. It is true that executive officers are effective, important agents, and they have certain powers. They have opinions about people and about cases. But the judiciary must act independently and not be influenced by their views. This is also one aspect.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
In the limelight.
The United States no longer teaches geography or foreign history in its schools. Has ever fewer foreign correspondents, glorifies war, and seems to view diplomacy as nothing more than foreplay before a military assault, says Chas W. Freeman, writer, in an article published under the heading U.S. Interest and Pretenses in a Changing West Asia. Stay tuned for more. Domestic political calculations, not the strategic pursuit of national interest, have just led Biden to affirm his fidelity to Zionism with a trip to the occupied Palestinian territories, called Israel, the only regime in the world where Donald Trump is more popular than he is. From the occupied Palestinian territories, the president traveled to Saudi Arabia, hat and emergency gas can in hand, to dine on symbolic crow as a guest of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, whom, to much domestic American applause, he had loudly denounced and pledged to make a pariah. But no one should be surprised that he didn't condemn the Saudi regime for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Neither he nor any other president has ever held the Zionist regime accountable for murdering Americans like Shirin Abu Aghila, Rachel Corrie, or the crew of the USS Liberty. Get real. Why should Biden be more concerned about a dead citizen of Saudi Arabia than about dead Americans? In Jeddah, the president bombed fist with MBS and made the Zionist regime's case for a normalized relationship with its Arab neighbors, despite its continuing cruelty to the Palestinian Arabs it oppresses. It doesn't get more demeaning than this. When interests and pretenses collide, interests prevail. When foreign and domestic interests are in conflict, domestic interests come first. Nothing unusual about that. Let's hear it for AIPAC and cheap gas. If it's obvious why Biden needed the Zionist regime and Saudi Arabia at this moment, it's less clear why they needed him. America has lost its grip on the West Asia region, which is now not its or any other great power's fiefdom. Diminished leverage in the region makes Washington a less compelling partner than it once was. The United States no longer attempts to achieve peace for the Palestinians. Regardless of doubts about Washington's reliability as a protector, the Zionist regime, the Arab participants in the eruption of realpolitik known as the Abraham Accords in Saudi Arabia all recognize that they have no real alternative to a U.S. security umbrella. No other great power is able to assume or indeed has any desire to take up American defense burdens in the region. But what's in it for Americans to soldier on? There are, in fact, serious matters at stake for the U.S. in West Asia beyond the sole reason the president gave to exclude Chinese and Russian influence there. Washington has set aside reliance on diplomatic persuasion in favor of coercive policies based on dollar sovereignty. The U.S. now imposes sanctions on any and all countries that defy its policies. This practice and the lawless confiscation of a growing number of countries' dollar reserves have put America at odds with much of the world. The dollar ceased to be convertible to gold in 1971. Since then, its centrality to global trade settlement and finance has been sustained by a Saudi commitment, which OPEC grudgingly follows, to price energy in dollars. Should the Saudis decide to accept other currencies for their oil, markets for other commodities would do the same. This would collapse the dollar and the exorbitant privilege it affords the United States and terminate U.S. global primacy. And this is not a small matter. To get from Asia to Europe or vice versa, you need permission to transit Saudi airspace. So, U.S. global strategic mobility is hostage to the kingdom's goodwill. The geopolitical cost of an unfriendly and uncooperative relationship with Riyadh would be immense. Saudi Arabia is the largest single foreign purchaser of both American and British defense equipment and services. Many production lines in the US and UK would shut down if the kingdom bought elsewhere. Lots of jobs would be lost. The US relationship with Saudi Arabia is, of course, not the only challenge to US strategic interests in the region. U.S. forces have illegally invaded Syria and are engaged there in dangerous maneuvers against Syrian forces. These confrontations risk wider wars, and not just in the region. The post-Saddam order disassembled battalions of the bloc unilaterally imposed on Iraq earlier this century is unstable and crumbling. Iraq's future alignments are in doubt. The Biden administration does not appear to have an answer to this. Egypt, the fake regime of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the UAE, among others, are attempting to dilute their strategic overdependence on the U.S. They do not share Washington's global obsessions, are alarmed by its erratic politics, resent its efforts to coerce them into placing dubious U.S. interests above their own, and will not downgrade relations with China and Russia to please America. The Zionist regime continues to terrorize and dispossess its captive Arab populations and to violate the sovereignty of neighboring states. The Zionist regime is increasingly dismissive of U.S. advice to restrain its violent behavior. It appears to believe that it has a blank check from America. Maybe it does. Others in the region want the U.S. to make them safe from the Zionist regime, not the Zionist regime safe from them. It's a truism that failure provides more lessons than success. But the U.S. no longer teaches geography or foreign history in its schools, has ever fewer foreign correspondents, glorifies war, and seems to view diplomacy as nothing more than foreplay before a military assault.
واحد دشنه بر لب تشنه بر لب تشنه بر لب تشنه
Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
Hussein, 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 I cry for you in pain. I cry for you in pain. I cry for you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
It took the Election Commission of Pakistan 7 years to conclude the illegal funding case against the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The case that was filed by one of the founding members of Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party maintained that his party received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities. In a 70-page judgment, the Election Commission confirmed that Tehreek-e-Insaf was guilty and concealed 16 bank accounts through which it accepted donations from foreigners or foreign groups.
I thank God that our 8-year struggle has paid off. I have no personal interest in this case. This is in the national interest that Pakistani political parties and their leadership must be subservient to the law.
The Election Commission also ruled that the former Prime Minister submitted false statements regarding his party's funding, but the party of Imran Khan has dismissed the charges.
We have been saying all along that this is not a case of foreign funding, but prohibited funding. Today's ruling has vindicated our stance that our political party has received no foreign funding.
The ruling comes over 3 months after Khan lost his office in a vote of no confidence in April. But Khan still insists he was ousted from power through a US-backed conspiracy.
Was there any crisis in the country when the US toppled our government? And those responsible in Pakistan to stop this conspiracy have acted as mere spectators.
Despite being ousted from power, Khan's popularity has increased. This was reflected in by-elections held recently in Punjab, where Khan's party swept the polls. The unexpected victory by Khan's party has allowed them to regain control of Punjab province.
There is no immediate fallout of the Election Commission's ruling on Khan and his party. Nevertheless, findings of the Election Commission may lead to legal challenges for the former Prime Minister. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Over the past few decades, China and the United States have been on the collision course on various issues, ranging from trade, human rights, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea, to the COVID-19 outbreak. The already tense relation has soured further with a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, a self-ruled island Beijing considers as part of its territory. Pelosi made a one-day trip to Taiwan during her ongoing East Asia tour, despite repeated warnings from Beijing that such a move could embolden pro-independence forces there. She used an Air Force plane to get to Taiwan, while over a dozen American fighter jets kept an eye on her. Upon arrival, Pelosi defended the controversial visit.
Our delegation's visit to Taiwan honors America's unwavering commitment to supporting Taiwan's vibrant democracy.
During her trip, Pelosi met with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. She was also awarded the highest civilian award as a, quote, symbol of America's strong and enduring friendship with the island. In response to the visit, Beijing has announced military drills, including a series of live fire maneuvers around Taiwan, including in the strategic Taiwan Strait. Taipei has reacted angrily, saying the drills and encircling of the island by Chinese forces are similar to an invasion. Beijing has also put curbs on some imports from Taiwan, while halting sand shipments to the island.
This is a complete farce. The United States is violating China's sovereignty under the guise of so-called democracy. Those who offend China will be punished. Those who play with fire will not come to a good end.
Pelosi has already concluded her trip to Taiwan, but it seems to have negative and far-reaching consequences for the island and the U.S., as Beijing has described Washington's action as extremely dangerous. Taiwan is not the only irritant issue in ties between Beijing and Washington. The U.S. is missing no chance to pit regional countries against China, whether there is a maritime dispute or other bilateral issues. The reality is that there are several economic, political, and strategic issues involved in U.S. policies in Asia-Pacific. One can also not ignore the constant U.S. meddling under the